producer.
You got a good radio voice, dude.
Thanks, bro. I appreciate that.
Really deep, nice voice.
You can get right up on the mic.
You can get all sexy on this thing.
So wait, you were just saying, like, off, we weren't recording yet, that you used to own Nirvana's old studio and Smashing Pumpkins was also in there?
Yeah, so it wasn't their studio. It was Butch Vig's studio. It's called Smart Studios. It's in Madison, Wisconsin. I owned it for about 5 years, and there's a movie on it called The Smart Studio Story on YouTube. Go and check it out. I think you got to rent it for $2.99 or something, but I think the movie came out 6 years ago. But yeah, I own that studio. It's Butch Vig was one of the greatest rock and roll producers of all times. He produced parts of Bleach, parts of Nevermind. A lot of that stuff was recorded in the studio, and I think they also did some recording in Los Angeles. But Smashing Pumpkins' first two albums, stuff by the Nine Inch Nails, Green Day, Beck, U2, like huge rock and roll studio in Madison.
Damn, dude. How did you even like acquire that? Like, it was just for sale, and you're like, dude.
Well, it's kind of a funny story because it was kind of like playing around in the back of my mind. I've owned a lot of properties, and I've owned like some old houses and restored them and fixed them up, old farms and stuff. And I rented out my farm in Wisconsin and in this one region in the country. And I moved to Madison. I was supposed to be moving to New Orleans, and all this stuff changed. Got to Madison, and I just needed an apartment. So I found an apartment, started renting. In the back of my mind, I was like, man, I think the recording studio that Butch Vig had with Nirvana and all this stuff was in Madison. And for the first year and a half or 2 years I was in Madison, it just kind of was in the back of my mind. Finally, I was like driving down East Washington as the main street in Madison. And I was like, I think this studio is on the street. And I was kind of checking out and just on my own instinct, there was this brick building, this old derelict brick building. It just looks like a crack house and like no windows, just nasty old brick building. I was like, I think that's it. I think that could be it. And I did some research, and sure enough, it was it. And every now and then I'd pass it. And then finally there was a lease sign on the side, this big, like huge lease sign. So I called the guy, and there's no answer, no return call for like 6 or 9 months. And finally I get a call this one morning and it was the dude. And he was like, hey, I'm the guy with, you know, this building. I was like, hey, was this Smart Studio? He's like, yeah, it's still intact. The studio's still there and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, cool. And he was like, would you rent it out? And he was like, yeah, I'd rent it out. And it was like really expensive. It's like $5,000 a month. And I was like, oh shoot, you know, I can't afford that. But I had a little bit of money from these last properties I restored and sold. And I was like, well, would you sell it? He's like, oh yeah, I'm trying to sell it. I was like, let's go. Let's do it. So here's where the story gets really interesting. And I'm not going to go too far into it because it'll take a long time. But so we made the deal. It was going to be a contract, a 5-year contract. And then I would have time to get a bank loan. So I was going to give him all my money as a down payment and just make him monthly payments. So we made the deal. The down payment was going to happen after I was going out west to do some shows. So at the time I had all of my money in cash, and I didn't trust leaving it in my apartment. So I brought it with me on this road trip, and I got stopped by the cops, and they thought it was like drug money or something, and they stole it.
What?
Yeah. They stole all this money from me.
No, what the fuck?
Yeah, dude, it was crazy. Like, absolutely. Like I said, the story goes really, really deep. And so I was there with the cops for like 6 hours or something. Like, they pulled my van apart. They thought for sure I was smuggling drugs and all this shit. And I was like, no, you know, like, this is my money, blah, blah, blah. And so they kept it. They kept it. And they made me sign a waiver that this is in Wyoming. They made me sign this waiver giving up my rights to this money that they took from me. And I kept asking them. I was like, well, if I don't sign this waiver, can I just go? Can I just like drive out of here? Like, I didn't do anything wrong. You stopped me for whatever reason, you know, I wasn't speeding, blah, blah, blah. And so they wouldn't answer me. They kept pushing to sign this
document.
This document. Yeah. It was like a waiver. And so So I signed it. I was like, okay, fine, I'll sign it. And I left. They had all of my money. I immediately started to research about this. Now I'm starting to get in the story. I ended up, took me 9 months and I got it back.
Oh, thank God.
The Institute for Justice represented me. It was a story on Vox.com. It was on CNN. It was like this huge story. So the senator of Wyoming ended up coming to this hearing 9 months later, because they tried to keep it. And they tried to say, okay, we closed the case. You know, you didn't show up at court, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't realize I had representation from the Institute of Justice. And so they were trying to do something illegal by just saying, since I didn't show up to the hearing, I forfeit the money. And so we had been in contact like 12 times through mail and email and everything else. We were like, hey, you never told us about the hearing, blah, blah, blah. We want to speak to the judge and reopen the case. We went out there. They tried to like cancel it because the news dropped on Vox.com. They had a film crew come out and like shoot the whole story of me and what happened.
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
The owner of the studio still agreed to do it and wait for this case to get over, luckily. But the Institute of Justice really liked that I was buying this famous studio.
Dude, shout out the Institute of Justice. Oh, damn.
Hella. Like, unbelievable thanks to the Institute for Justice and Dan, who was the lawyer that believed in me and came out to vet me.
Crazy.
And yeah, absolutely insane. So we got the money. We got it back. I bought the studio and everything went through.
Nice.
Yeah.
Damn. So I'm, damn, we're starting out hot here. So
yeah, the story gets, let me just add one little thing. So that the senator called me, he showed up to the hearing that we had. He called me in the morning while we were out there and he's like, would you like me to come to this hearing? I was like, sure. He's like, I'm 2 hours away. I'll make it. So he made it. He apologized and he's like, hey, I've been trying to change this law forever. It's called civil forfeiture and police are allowed to take whatever they want and say it could be related to whatever and keep it. They don't have to claim it to the government.
The cops know, like bad cops.
They
use
know.
That.
There's schools that they go to that are expensive to get trained in how to do it properly so that they can keep all this stuff. And they don't have to report it to the government. They buy boats. They buy vacation packages. It's a thing. They make $256 million a year on it.
Whoa.
So the senator finally, after my case, got the law changed. Why they had been changing the laws in all of America, except for a few states. Wyoming was one of the few. And the senator called me months later and he's like, hey, Phil, I want to let you know we finally got the law changed in Wyoming and we're calling it the Phil Bill.
What?
true story.
Dude, that's fucking sick.
Crazy. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And the unfortunate
legendary.
The unfortunate thing is my face is on the internet now with like everyone's going to go look up Vox.com and see the article and everything. And it's a little bit embarrassing, but hey, represent, we got the money back and hopefully it doesn't happen to anybody else.
Fuck yeah, man. Damn. So, okay.
Crazy.
Wow. You got the studio and how's the studio? Is it like a really cool spot? Does it still have all the magic?
So I did sell it 2 years ago. So that time has run its course. I've owned it. I owned it for about 5 years. It was unbelievable. Like working in the space that platinum albums were done in, you know, Nevermind was done there. Gish, self-titled Smashing Pumpkins was done. Like those are legendary albums. So walking in the footsteps of greatness, when you go to record, you know, or you're going to work on songs, it just changes your whole mindset.
Yeah,
it really did.
And is it in good quality? Did you have to do a lot of refurbishing?
The studios were intact. There was no equipment there. It had been empty for many years when I got it. It was just being used by storage by the guy.
But still
storage.
Like soundproof.
Perfect.
And stuff. Oh,
perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sick. So no mold or like weird shit. I mean, maybe a little mold. Yeah.
The basement was a swamp. The basement was like really intense. Like it flooded twice when I was there. Cost me a lot of like replace the furnaces, like 4 feet of water both times. So there's some mold kind of things that I had to deal with, but the studios, they, after Nirvana's, you know, success, they put a lot of money into the whole studio and it was just absolutely perfect. Mm. Like the best quality of sound you can get, just perfect. The listening room, the playing room was just dialed.
That's so cool. And I'm sure you like swagged it out with like lights and like whatever, just like vibe.
Well, we also had shows there. So I was running shows for like the after parties of the big electronic shows. So Sudden
Death, Madison.
In Madison. Yeah, we had Toadface there. We had a lot of really awesome dubstep artists come through after their shows for after parties where they would perform and I would perform and other artists in the area would perform. So we were running this like community kind of like meeting spot after the shows.
Wow. That's so cool, dude.
Yeah. It was amazing.
Oh man. Yeah. So I don't know. There's a lot of ways I could go here, man. It's like, that's just so interesting. You know, I don't talk to a lot of people who have, you know, been able to own a studio, mm-hmm. you know, everyone's got their home studio, but you know, were you tracking people? Like, were you like using it as a means to a business, you know, like, cause you can use it as a business too, or you could just go in there and be like, yo, like, I got a sick studio.
So there was an upstairs and a downstairs. Studio B was upstairs, a smaller one, and Studio A was downstairs, the big, huge, gorgeous one. I lived in Studio B. Upstairs was a small apartment too. So I lived there and was doing Star Monster there. That's where I started Star Monster and started working on it really hard. Downstairs, the first year and a half, I rented to some bands, some friends of mine who are bands. And they did video performances, they tracked albums, they did all kinds of stuff there. It's so hard to rent practice space, and it, like, no one has money in music.
I know. Yeah, it's like you feel bad, you're like, yeah, you can get it a little cheaper.
Yeah, and like the place was already so expensive with the, like the taxes in Madison are crazy and the insurance and everything. My payments were just really high, so I was struggling and I didn't want to overcharge anybody. So really, we just kind of bare-boned it, you know. It was those guys there for a while, and then we were doing the shows on the weekend with that, and then I finally sold it. But
nice, man. Well, it sounds like it had a good run at least. And is someone still using it as a studio?
No. So somebody from Los Angeles bought it, and they turned it into a bed and breakfast now.
Fuckers.
I know.
I mean, damn.
I know. And they, and like, I won't get into it, but yeah, it's a shame. That one of the weird things is that studio was so loved in Madison and so revered that since we were doing electronic music shows in there and doing these after shows and stuff, half of the community absolutely loved it because it was like lifeblood in Madison is going again. You know, the studio, which is the heart of Madison, is like happening again. And then the other half was like, what's he doing in there? He's trapping it out. You know, they're just doing drugs.
Oh, yeah. Blah, it's blah, like, blah. This is like a travesty type of thing. Like, this was high art, and now you're, look what you're doing.
Trashing
now.
It. You Damn. Know, and like, and there are some people on some blogs that, you know, came out and just did scathing reviews of me and blah, blah, blah. And
bro, so people are out for you, man. Yeah. What the hell?
Yeah. It bothered me. It was tough. It's like, come through, man. We're doing some really cool things here. And it's, you know, again, a vital music place like it should be.
It's so weird to me that all this stuff has happened to you and then people are like, you know, I guess that just comes with like having like influence that people just try to like bring you down. But you just, I don't know you that well. We've just met. And you don't seem like a guy that deserves that, man. You seem like a nice guy. Like, what the hell? Yeah,
I think I get treated pretty good for the most part, you know, but
there
have been some flukes, and it's like, yeah, I think it's just like just doing music, you know, people tend to think if you're doing music, you're making tons of money or you're,
that's so funny,
or you have power. Or some, you know.
Maybe some influence, okay.
Yeah, like, maybe when you get to the level of Excision you do or something, you know, but freaking nowhere near that. Like, I'm just a garage musician.
But you're grinding. I'm grinding
my ass off, yeah, for sure.
Well, you know, I didn't introduce, and I normally do like a delayed introduction, don't know why, but I'll do one now. Yo, what's up, guys? Welcome to Podducer, the podcast for producers. Today we are joined by Star Monster.
What's up?
Okay, so this was the burning question. What is a Star Monster?
I'm glad you asked that.
And I'm sorry if people have asked you before. I couldn't find it.
I've always wanted to make like one post that just spells it out so that people know.
And, here we go.
So here's a chance.
Yo, what's up, guys? Before we get into today's show, I want to take a quick moment to talk about our sponsor, Quake. As music producers and concert enthusiasts, we know how important it is to protect our ears. That's where Quake's Dove Muffs V2 come in. They aren't just any earplugs, they're a game changer. What sets Dove Muffs V2 apart? First off, their quality. They're better than any plugs I've ever used. I use them all the time. I have custom in-ear plugs. These are my main ones that I bring to shows. You get premium sound clarity, preserving those crisp highs and deep lows, all while safeguarding your ears from damaging volumes. And the best part, they don't break the bank. Quality and affordability, son. Let's talk customization. Quake knows one size doesn't fit all. That's why they offer two sizes. Whether you're at an intimate gig or a massive festival, Dove Muffs V2 fit comfortably in your ears, making sure you're protected no matter how long the show lasts. Let's face it, we've all left concerts with ringing in our ears. It's not good, but it ends up happening. But it doesn't have to be that way. Protect your ears while enjoying the pure sound of music with Quake's Dove Muffs V2. As a special thank you to our listeners, Quake is offering an exclusive discount. Just use the code POD15 at checkout to save on your first purchase. As a motto of our show, make sure you protect your ears. Now let's get back to the show. Also, I just want to let you guys know before we get back to the show, shameless plug, we are doing our first round of merch. They are green corduroy ball caps with the Podducer logo embroidered on them. They're pretty sweet. They cost $35. And if you purchase one, it really helps us out to keep doing what we are doing here. You can find a link to purchase one in the link tree on any Podducer social media. Like I said, your support really helps. Okay, sorry, shameless plug. We'll get back to the show.
So it was the working title for the movie Aliens before they changed the movie to Alien. So while they were working on the movie, it was called Star Monster.
The second Alien? Aliens?
The first one.
The first one, okay.
The first one. That movie was
called... Oh, that makes so much sense.
Star Monster. So we were at... my friends and I were at Electric Forest. Liquid Stranger was playing, and I think he just... You know, we were getting into it, blah, 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 and I was imagining all these aliens and stuff, and he was like, do you know... And I just read on Reddit that the... working title of the movie Alien with Star Monster, and I was like, that's your DJ name, bro, go with Star Monster. And it was kind of a joke, you know, and he's like, I don't want it. And then 6 months later I wrote my first electronic song, and I was like, hey bro, do you still want that name, Star Monster? I need to go with it. He's like, yeah, you got it.
Damn, that's cool, man. I just saw that they're gonna be making a new Alien. Ooh. Romulus or something.
Ooh, the new ones have been good.
The new ones, okay, the only thing I have about the newest one is when they like
Prometheus.
The one after Prometheus is like Covenant.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. But they got on the planet and they just took off their helmets right away. And I was like, guys, what are we doing? That was my only qualm. But they look visually so cool.
Yeah. I've been impressed with the new ones. Like, yeah. I've been like, damn, okay. I feel like the third one was the bad one. Mm. Third one was kind of cheesy. Like, you saw the formula of like, the same sort of characters in the movie being played out, even in a more character. I don't know how to explain it, but
so are you a big Alien fan? Are you a big sci-fi guy?
You know, I really do love sci-fi. I can't say like I'm a huge, like there are people that are freaking fans and they know everything. You know, I'm not like that, but I do really love sci-fi. I did, you know, do a minor in film in art school, and I'm obsessed with film. So there's other kinds of films that I'm a little bit more obsessed with, but I love sci-fi. I really
Is Ridley Scott like up there with the directors? Like, you know, obviously just cause the Aliens thing.
I love him. I mean, I think he's amazing. I think he's really good, but there's other guys I like more, you know. I like modern guys like Ari Aster a lot, and older guys I like, you know, the classics, you know, like Akira Kurosawa and all those guys.
Mm. Nice. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad that we got to cover Star Monster and the reasoning.
Yeah. And it's like the name to me has always been kind of a fun, funny name, you know, Star Monster.
Yeah.
I've never been an I don't make music like that, like head banging, tear out dubstep. But so to me, it was kind of a fun name. But
yeah,
Space Wizard is kind of a fun name.
Yeah. And it's like also, you know, your visuals are very cohesive project to project. I actually wanted to ask you about that because it is cohesive. Do you work with an artist on that?
As me.
As you. Okay. As so me. Wait, yeah. We'll get into that. I have some questions on that.
Yeah, I love to talk about that.
But yeah, it's very like, you know, fun. The art is very fun. You know, it's not like sinister looking and yeah, like raunchy looking, but the music is, there's some raunch, but yeah, it's not like tear out either.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just think it's cool when artists string together their project and there is this cohesive imagery to it.
Oh,
I think you do that well. Yeah.
Awesome. That's good to hear. Yeah. People have liked the artwork and that always means a lot to me because I feel like, I really do feel like it's half of the package, you know, like even if the visual component is only a cover that's there. I remember as a kid just getting a CD or whatever and just being obsessed with it and like
just looking at it.
Hopefully the book opens up and there's more in there and there's more clues as to what I'm diving into.
Yeah.
You know? And it's all clues as to like how you should be framing it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. I've always thought that like the art should reflect kind of like the auditory imagery of it, you know, like the colors of it should make sense with the colors of the sound. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know. So you did say, I mean, this was one of my questions. You said that it's 50% for you, and I'm assuming that means 50% of your creative, like, you know, output is half of it's music, half of it is doing the art. And I kind of just wanted to unpack that and also talk about, you know, like how did you get into doing graphic art? You know, we, as artists, people wear a lot of hats. You have to do a lot of things.
Yeah.
But
it's crazy.
But I mean, I think you're really effective at it. Some people, you know, it's like they get something and it looks okay, but yours look polished.
Cool. That's good to hear. Cause like, honestly, after it leaves my brain and goes into reality, I don't know anymore. Like I've spent so much time pickling it and thinking about it and changing it. I just hope it works. I don't know what other people are feeling like, but that's great to hear. Yeah. So I wish I spent 50% of my time on the art as I do the music, but unfortunately for me, the music takes so freaking long to complete songs that it's probably the actual time spent is like 95% of the music and 5% of the art. But went to art school, went to a really good art school in Nova Scotia. I was really poor growing up and I happened to be really good at art and won a full scholarship.
Dude.
Yeah.
Critical strike right there.
Yeah. And it was like just portfolio based, you know, you turn in a portfolio and I could draw really well at a young age, you know? So I just kind of had that. So for me, that was my cutting of my teeth, you know, it was like really being able to dive in and out of any style I wanted to somehow.
What was the portfolio mainly at that time to get in to the Nova Scotia?
It was, some life drawings. You had to have a life drawing, portfolio. So maybe about, I think it was about 15 to 20 life drawings, which is a model that you're looking at and drawing, usually a nude model, some portrait, some body, and then some design type work, some painting type work. If you're really good at sculpture, maybe you're going more towards sculpture and you're showing some sculptures you've made. So trying to show your like creative side and then your just your draftsmanship, your hand, how good of a drawer you are. So it was this kind of portfolio of maybe 12 major pieces and then your drawings.
Gotcha. And this is a naive question. I've definitely heard in Nova Scotia, but where is that?
Canada. Okay. So it's like a peninsula in Canada over Maine.
Okay.
In the Atlantic. Really nice. Beautiful little spot. Yeah. It's a world port too. Halifax is a world port. So these big super freighters are pulling in with those little like back of semis that are stacked thousands on the things. And that's and we would like sneak up on those things too, which is pretty cool.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Some crazy crazy fun adventures.
Like the ones with like the big crates where they're like,
the
shipping containers.
Exactly. Yeah. And just like thousands of them stacked up in like huge freighters.
Dude, you're on the boat and then they're like leaving and you're just like, no.
Yeah. It's crazy. Like they would have these little catwalks, these like thin, maybe 1 foot long with ropes, just like string up to it. Like, see, and obviously they're closed for, you're not supposed to be going up, but like 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning, we would just like
go check it out.
And like, there would always be an old boatman, you know, and like 3 sweaters and like holes through each of the sweaters, like carving an apple with a pocket knife, you know, at the top of it.
That guy.
Yeah. From Turkey, you know, and then he'd bring us down and give us coffee and show us the engine room. And
oh, stuff. He was
and
cool.
He was, at first we were scared because he had a pocket knife, but he ended up being cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So, okay, you find yourself there. This is the origin story of the podcast. You find yourself there. What's kind of next?
So, I find myself in art school. Yeah, so I majored in painting, minored in film, got a job in the NFL doing film for the Cleveland Browns.
Tight.
Yeah, and then worked in Europe for NFL Europe doing the same thing. I ran the film department over there, worked there.
What does NFL Europe look like? Because I'm curious. Now I'm like, shouldn't it be rugby or something?
Yeah, so the NFL started kind of like a minor leagues over there with 6 teams. I worked for the team in Amsterdam, and they basically did it to spread the brand to Europe because Europe doesn't care about American football. And they make a lot of money from the merchandise. They make a lot of money from the jersey. So they're like, they want to spread that market. And like this year, they think they're going to have a game in Brazil. Every year they've been having a game in London. But in these days, they had a full league. They had a 6-team league. We played each team twice, I think. And yeah.
That's pretty cool. I didn't even realize that existed. But to get like a Netherlands or Amsterdam jersey, NFL jersey,
Admirals.
That sounds like a deep cut.
Yeah.
Like people don't, I've never heard of that. I'm not a huge sports guy, you know, football's not my thing necessarily either, but I feel like for the collectors that's a good jersey.
Yeah. The jerseys were cool. The London Monarchs, the Scotland. Oh, what was the Scotland team called? Rhine Fire, Dusseldorf Galaxy. I think I'm getting all those names right.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah.
So you lived in Amsterdam also.
Yeah, I got to live there for 4 years.
That's so cool.
It was awesome. I loved it. Amsterdam is an enchanted little town.
It's called the Netherlands, so it just feels like another realm over there. It's a small little country, and it's so, the people there, they're just tall and beautiful. And
they are tall. Yeah.
And just like,
I'd be in bars and I would just be like,
guys, hey. Yeah. That's cool. What's like, I don't know, just to stick on this for a second.
Yeah.
If you go to Amsterdam and you're giving someone travel advice who's going to go there, where do you got to go? Like, is it the red light district? Is it?
Well,
like,
yeah, I mean, you got to
check it out. Yeah.
You got to see that. That's very, it's fascinating. You know, Central Station and that whole area. And the Jordan. The Jordan is the west side. So Amsterdam is like a thumbprint of rings. So the center is in the middle. And then there's rings going out, and each one is a canal, like Venice. So there's little bridges, everything's cobblestone, those old, beautiful, skinny buildings that kind of lean. And the Jordan is one of the old traditional areas that's left on the west side. And in the bars there, they still sing these old songs and stuff every night. It's pretty cool.
That's so cool. I was fortunate enough to go to Amsterdam, and I was just so high the whole time.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was great. Like, people are biking around. Everyone bikes there. It's the best. Like,
I biked the whole time. It was really cool.
Yeah, it's so cool.
Old people on bikes.
Yeah. Everyone's biking. It's great. That's how you stay in shape, you know?
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, so are you making music over there? When does the music start?
Yeah, so
okay, also I'll just preface this. I know you were in a band, a couple bands, I think. Yeah. So maybe break it down.
Okay. Yeah. There's a lot.
There's
there.
A lot. So, yeah.
So when I was really young, you know, in elementary school, I was really into creating like movies and creating, you know, and this stuff you'd draw on a piece of notebook paper and make the movie title, blah, blah, blah. So we had this, I had this band that I made up and these songs and these albums and stuff. And finally an uncle gave me this 4-track tape machine, super old school. And it's just, he didn't know it was a 4-track, but it had 4 tracks and you can record on each of those 4 tracks. Although it was made to play stereo albums at that time, like Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Wall, you can, Dark Side of the Moon, sorry, you could buy on a
the wall, Dark Side of the Moon, yeah,
just combine them all in one.
Dark Side of the Wall is kind of cool.
That, why didn't they do that,
make like a remix album where it's like the song, I don't know, something, there's something there.
There's something there, Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Wall. Anyways, it, like, you could buy a tape reel of that album at those times. Anyway, so he gave us this 4-track and I figured out how to record on these 4 tracks. So in our basement, I think I had the Casio SK1, the little like sampling keyboard, that first tiny little one. And my brother had a drum machine. He had a bass. I had a guitar. And we just started laying down like songs, track by track. And that was really the start of it. We were called Gray Radio, had a logo, and we're just into it, you know, but it was just kid stuff. It was like ridiculous kid stuff, but it just kept growing within me. Like I kept really, really wanting to do it more than art. You know, art came so easy to me. Music didn't. Music was harder to get it good. You know, if you're not very good at music, it sounds bad. It just sounds like you laugh because it sounds bad. And that kind of continued through art school. After art school, I was like getting kind of ushered to show in galleries and stuff. And I just didn't like it. I was like, okay, like these, I don't really have anything to do with these people. These are rich, affluent, like well-educated people who like are into the hottest, you know.
Could you have seen yourself making like good money from that? Like, but you were just, the vibe was off.
Dude, it was on. Like, to be honest, it was on. Like it was just, it was happening.
Really?
And yeah, it was happening. And I just shut it down. I was like, I just don't really want to do this. I don't really want the wine and cheese parties. I don't want to be surrounded by pretentious people in suits and da da da. Like I didn't feel right. And the biggest thing for me is I didn't feel like my art was going to reach people. I felt like it was only going to reach the super in the know people, artsy folks. And at that time I really had lofty ideas about my art and where I wanted it to go. You know, I really wanted to change the world. I wanted to affect people. And I saw music affecting rich, poor, young, and old. You know, it's just instant poetry. It comes into you. But I sucked at it. I wasn't very good. But I kept getting more and more into it. And then I met in Nova Scotia. There was one student, Jeff Kearns, who became my best friend. And he was from Minneapolis and was just obsessed with music and had ties to like the whole scene there, which was just huge at that time. And so I ended up moving to Minneapolis after that and got really into live bands and still sucked, but got better and better over time. And then finally started to create my own bands.
Yeah. Just to stick on this for one sec, because I know that there's another band and there was something that I read. I was like, what? So we'll get into that. But it feels like for what you're saying kind of is that art, at least in the visual art, it came easy to you. But music, there was this thing that was like intangible about it. It was harder. And maybe you liked the challenge of it?
I think I did like the challenge of it, but I just liked the result of it. I like that when you made it really well, what it did to people.
I
can make a beautiful painting. It could be realistic and blah, 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 and like be impressive to some people, but doesn't do much. You know, it sits on the wall and you're like, wow, it's a beautiful painting. But when you hear a really good song, you want to hear it all the time. It just comes into your heart. You feel good. You feel warm. You feel sad if it's a sad song. It helps you, you know, it reaches.
Yeah, it does something to your brain in a different way because it's like on a timeline. It literally, not to sound corny, but it takes you on a journey. And I've also found that music is the most potent in that sense, that it really can take you out. I mean, a good movie, I think that, you know,
I agree
like
with that.
Like
movies and music.
because I think that the two things that they share is the timeline aspect, that you push play on it and then it runs its course, whereas a painting is just something that is a constant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, there's a story in it, you know, of course, but it's not the same medium. And I think there's something special about that medium.
I agree. And I know there's going to be art people out there that just consider me, just going to tear me apart and consider me an idiot. I understand. Like, I really love art as well. I really do. That I can get a lot out of, I can go to a museum and get a lot of satisfaction from some artists I really love, but it just doesn't hit me the same way. You know, I've only been in tears a couple times from a painting, probably when I was really into painting it, you know, but music, I can hear a song on the way home that maybe will grab me, you know, and shake me up. But I just feel like, and it is that temporal thing too, of like, you're moving through time on this journey and you're trusting at each point. Like, you, the song starts, if it's not good, you
get rid of it. Yeah, there is a trust. That's so real. I never even thought about that. But like, if it's not exciting enough, if it doesn't go a certain way, you're like,
The sounds don't resonate. The melody isn't hitting you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad we're on the same page about this. I wanted to go back to the band thing just because I read that you, from actually EDM Identity, shout out, you guys did a nice little interview. The Dirt Bros.
The Dirt Bros.
Does that make sense in the next step chronologically?
Definitely. Yeah. So the Dirt Bros, and it's still going. Like, it's, that band is not done. That band has been everything to me. Like, ended up going back to my roots, and really getting into this really early form of the blues, which is called fife and drum music. There's a couple artists that extrapolated it to guitar, R.L. Burnside and Mississippi Fred McDowell. And I got into my dad's music collection at a young age, his blues collection, just fell in love with that. I didn't really like the 12-bar blues. I didn't really like the predictable blues, but I liked this African tradition. Ended up learning more about it and figuring out that it was what started hip hop and rap. It's like, it's the beginning of that funky stuff. And it's African music. I could go way more into detail, but I'll just kind of stop there. But so this, I ended up having other bands, kind of doing, I was really obsessed with Zeppelin and the Beatles and blah, blah, blah. And, like, when I say obsessed, like 10 years, like just crazy, like learning everything about it, having some of the gear, blah, blah, blah. And then finally I just kind of, everything just kind of came into one thing with the Dirt Bros. And I just started writing all these songs with a friend of mine who played a circus, 1920 circus bass drum with a mallet on the side of the drum.
Like a dum dum, like one of those, like a timpani, but like you hold it. And
exactly. Interesting. Yeah. I was playing like out of old antique amplifiers. I was learning how to turn an antique radio into an amplifier. And
that's so cool.
Yeah. Super weird old like 1950s guitars. And just
that tuning sound. I always like wanted to find a good way to emulate that. Like, yeah. That sound. But I feel like the best way, you just get a radio.
Old radio. Yeah. So I was just obsessed with sound and that old kind of old school way of doing things. And started just doing little tours on our own, you know, just going around the country and playing in New Orleans and playing in Brooklyn and playing here and there, and did that for many, many years, and didn't give a crap about marketing ourselves, didn't give a crap about anything. And eventually, so predating the Dirt Bros, we were, for a short time, the band had this other name and turning into the Dirt Bros, but I'd sent some stuff to this album, this label called Fat Possum, down south. They were doing the Black Keys. They had worked with R.L. Burnside and a bunch of, like, one of my favorite independent labels. And they really liked it and they wanted to sign us. And so we ended up, started working with the Black Keys manager at the time.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things you're saying that are crazy.
Yeah. And like this music I recorded in my barn, like literally was not playing any big shows anywhere. Like no one would have known about us. And the guy was like, well, how were you not on our radar? Like how did we not hear of you? And it's like, yeah, I just recorded this in my barn, blah, blah, blah. And, anyways, that started this whole chain of events, ended up going to Burning Man and left it all behind because I found dubstep.
So wait, here did we you are. Did you go to Burning Man with the band, or that was a separate?
I didn't go with the band. So the band was just two people, me and the guy on the drum. Yeah. Yeah.
What's and the guy's name? Can we shout him?
Adam.
Out? Adam. Shout out Adam.
Adam Cook. What's up, Adam? So yeah, I went to Burning Man and I brought the bass drum. He wasn't going to go, but I brought my guitar and amp and stuff, and I ended up performing at all these little camps and stuff. And I would get somebody to play the drum, but I ended up discovering dubstep, which I didn't really know was a thing. This is 2010, and I just became in love with it and kind of left all that behind pretty quickly.
So I'm curious, what pushed you to go to Burning Man? Have you always kind of been like free spirit like that? That it just was on your radar? You're like, I got to go to that.
You know, I had never been to a festival at that time, and I had no interest at all. I had a friend that was, I lived in Washington on this island. I was restoring this home on this island in Washington. And I had this friend that I met, and she was like, you just have to go. You just like, it's incredible. You have to go. You're going to love it. And I didn't think I would love it. I was like, man, it just doesn't sound.
Sounds like a bunch of hippies. No, I'm just kidding.
Like, it just sounds like a bunch of like really heavy drug users, like over partying in my face. I just didn't like the sound of it, but I didn't really know anything about it. So last minute, it was like she had already left for it. And it was like 3 or 4 days before it was going to start. I was alone on the, in this house on this island. And I was like, I just want to go to this thing. I want to try. I don't know what I had this calling. And so last minute, I think I looked on Craigslist, found a ticket, drove down there, got in there all alone, didn't know a soul, and just went in. And the first day I was kind of freaked out because it was all dubstep at that time.
I was also going to say, it's like not an easy festival in the sense that you like have to be prepared. I don't know exactly what goes into preparation, but I know people do prep, and like it's not just like you buy a hotel and you just go back to your hotel, you know. It's
you're in
the desert,
you're freaking in it, surviving in like 100 and some degrees during the day and like could be 50 at night, you know. It's severe. If you don't have any water, you're like, you're not going to survive, although hopefully someone
will help you. Yeah,
and they will, but yeah, no, it's tough. It's tough. And I had a Honda Odyssey and I just camped out in it.
Car? That's what I would do.
Yeah. It worked great.
Yeah.
It worked really good.
But the Odyssey's a van.
Dude. Yeah.
The Odyssey's perfect.
Perfect. Turn on the AC if you need to. Hopefully you got enough gas when you go in there.
Yeah. True. Yeah. That's real.
But it just changed my life. It was amazing. I couldn't believe like the community of people there, how freaking open and wanting to connect and interact with you. Everybody, 100% of the people, not 99.9, like 100% of the people. You just walk up to anybody and you've got an amazing conversation going. But yeah, that was when I first heard dubstep. The first day I hated it, I went to bed like just absolutely
being like, what is this robot music?
Yeah, I just heard these noises like constantly in my head, and I was like, fuck, dude, I gotta deal with this for like a week. But then the next day I tried acid and then it all changed.
There you go. So one thing about Burning Man, I feel like 2010, that was like a great time to go. Now it seems like it's been, you know, a little bit captured by like, you got some rich people going there, and literally no hate on Burning Man. I've never been there, but it just feels like maybe it's changed a little bit. Have you been back?
I was there last year. I've been like,
still good.
13 times, dude. It's still
13 times, dude. What? That's so cool.
A1. Like, I highly, highly stand behind it.
If I go, I want to go so bad. Can you, like...
I got you.
Can you tell me what to do?
Yeah.
Okay.
You camp with me.
I would love to go, man.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll form a little camp. We'll get it.
Okay, this might be a fun little segment. What is, like, the do's and don'ts? Or, like, what are, like, the essentials? Like, things that you... If you're going to go, this is your kit. Things that you need. Is it gas is like the most important
thing? Well, yeah. I mean, when you go in, your car definitely should be full of gas. So in case you need to turn it on for and get a little AC or whatever going, you know, if it gets really bad for you. You really need a structure with shade over it, or an RV with AC, because that heat will crush you. Because it's so fun at night, you won't sleep until like 8 to 10 a.m. the next day at the earliest. And then by then the sun is already just, you know, crushing you and you won't sleep. And especially if it's sun directly hitting your tent, it's going to be 150 degrees in your tent. So that shade above your tent cools it perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, as long as that sun's not. And so water, you need about 10 gallons of water at least, your own food, your own waste management. You know, you want to, it's all pack in, pack out. You don't drop anything on the ground. So it, like, you have to be very mindful of that. But those are the essentials, you know, and then whatever you want to wear, like obviously bring some fun stuff to wear. Don't be boring.
Yeah. Don't be business casual at Burning Man. Yeah.
Don't just go in your sweats or whatever. You like, come on.
Yeah. Damn, dude, that's so cool. So you said that that's where you found dubstep, and that was in 2010. So it's been a minute. Things have changed a lot, but there is a resurgence of dubstep right now. That's pretty nice.
Yeah. You know, the unfortunate thing about the burn is it's mostly house now.
Is it?
Unfortunate for me, because I like dubstep. I like bass music more than house. I'm not against house, but it is too much house now.
Yeah, I feel like too much anything is I like house, but I want a little breakbeat.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to change it up. And there is bass music, but it's like not much. But it is, hopefully it's going to come back more. It hasn't yet, but it Camp Q is the one. Camp Q is the big bass camp, and there's a few others, but Camp Q is the big one.
Yeah, it's a big encampment. Like it's like a whole city.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Gnarly. Yeah, I think last year, I don't think they were honest about the amount of people there. I think it was reported to be, what, 80,000 or something?
Oh, because it was like the fiasco, right? Because there was like the mud or something?
Well, the mud, one, because of that, I think it's also they have permitted so many, you know, it's a state park, so you can only have so many people in there. And by the time it really hits peak, it's probably a little bit more. But I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like it's like lawless out there.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. That's so cool. Well, you know, we've gotten this far, and I feel like maybe it would be cool to just show people a track. I feel like Dimension, or yeah.
Right? I think that's the one.
I think that would make the most sense. Dimensions.
Dimensions, yeah. Let's play that one.
I guess let's play it, and then we can talk about it. But I do have some questions specifically about the sample. Sounds like there might be a Twilight Zone reference in there.
Yeah.
There could be. Is that what that was? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. We'll run it. I'll probably fade it out or something.
Cool.
I love the space. Like, there's like enough negative space that like each different wub.
Yeah, you get to hear the edges of those sounds.
That shit's massive. Damn, bro. It's different when you listen with headphones.
Oh, yeah.
I got a couple questions. First of all, are you a Twilight Zone fan? Like, do you like the weird stuff?
Hell yeah! Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Psychedelic is what I've always loved.
Gotcha.
And
yeah.
Twilight Zone is as psychedelic as it gets.
Hey, dude, it's weird. It's so good. I love it. Do you like Black Mirror? Because that's kind of like the modern day Twilight Zone.
Yeah, for sure.
Sometimes it gets too heady and techy that I'm like, oh God, is this going to happen? Like, it's going to happen. And I'm a little bit worrisome. But okay, so this song, correct me if I'm wrong, this is off the 80 Day album, right?
Yes.
Like this. And can we talk about that? Where you were like, I'm going to make an album in 80 days. And every day you like make a video. How's that going? Is it still going?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you upload today?
I have to.
You still have to. Okay.
I missed yesterday.
Oh no. So what started that idea and how has that, you know, impacted your workflow? Like, was this one of the first tracks you made?
So I saw a number of artists doing it. Shout out to Barkley Crenshaw and some other artists that I saw doing it. And I was like, man, that's a hella good idea. 'Cause I'm up in here every day grinding out. And like the most interesting thing to really, in my mind, give to people on Instagram who are following me is like what I'm actually doing. It's like today I'm writing a remix. Today I'm working on the mix down of this song. Today I'm, you know, those things to me just seemed the most valuable. So I kind of saw those artists doing it. I was like, this is a great idea. And it also gives people a chance to like really know who I am and really follow along with the journey of what it is to make an album. I think the 80 days is a challenge, and it puts it in a pressure cooker too. It's like, okay, here we go. Let's see if you can do this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can't dally. You can't overthink. And I think my thing has always been overthinking, you know, like sometimes I work on songs too long, like the Game Over song. I worked on that song for 9 months, like almost exclusively on that song. Wow. It's just too much. It's just too much. So I'm trying to force myself. And my favorite way of creating is I like making like 4 or 5 songs a day. Like that's really what I'm best at. Thing that's hardest for me is like the mix down and making
the finalizing
and getting all that in there, you know, and making sure the mix down is really clean. So this was a way for me to find a better, to force myself to find a more efficient way of working and also show people what I'm doing and the different offshoots of what making an album can be. Sometimes it's days on the art. Sometimes it's whatever, you know?
Yeah. And this one, I just feel like this track was a point where you were like, yes, I've got something here because the Dimensions tour.
Yeah.
And that came from this idea, right?
Yeah. It came from the artwork, the whole feeling I wanted, you know, the feeling of, it's like each time you go to making a body of work, you have to check in with yourself and kind of say, okay, what is the most compelling thing in this form of expression to me at this point in my life? And for me, it's always been these like, well, especially with electronic music, these different realms you can get into, you know, you can get into dimensions and feelings of things that you can't with normal instruments and normal singing, song making, you know, in my mind, like electronic music has the ability to create sounds never heard before. So this song for me was like, and the artwork was trying to pull that all together in the way that makes sense to me right now.
I feel like when we were listening to it, I was saying that there's like a lot of nice space, and then you were saying that like you could hear the edges of the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it kind of feels like these sounds are coming from another dimension, like into the thing. And I mean, you can get some otherworldly sounds with recording stuff, right? There's some things on planet Earth, like some fruit that looks like it's an alien fruit, right?
Totally.
Like if you just saw some weird fruit out of context, you'd be like, yeah, that's from some other planet. But I do feel like you have the ability to make a sound and then also craft the space in it, add reverb and all those things, and just really make it sound totally otherworldly, and I feel like electronic music, I completely hear what you're saying about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's like, what is that sound? That wah, wah, what, like, why does that make sense? Is it a horn? Is it some vowel of our voice that we're able to say, hey, this is an instrument that I believe in. This will lead this song, and I'll go through this journey listening to this crazy sound.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any
sense. No, it makes sense. I feel like what I just said doesn't make sense either, but it's cool. So what's like the game plan? How many days are we on? So like this will come out after, I don't know how long it's going to take, but like currently as of this recording, where are we at?
So this is day 47. And so there's been a label that's shown interest in a song. It was actually that song, but I'd already slated it for release and we couldn't remove it. So now I'm like, I want to give them an EP, but I also want to complete this album. So right now I have a lot of songs, like a lot of plate spinning. And then I have a remix EP that I'm dropping on SoundCloud as well. So I've had these remixes that I've been working on. So I probably have like 30 songs that I'm like trying to complete at this point.
Damn. And the remix is the Space Dust Volume 1.
Space Dust Volume 1. Yeah. I dropped the first song last week.
Yeah.
The No Quarter.
So you're kind of spinning a bunch of plates.
Spinning a lot of plates. And it's probably really stupid. It's probably what artists are doing all the time. You know, you don't know when a label is going to put something out. If they show interest, it's very valuable to get that to happen. Sometimes for me, it is right now. So you never know when that's going to happen. So if it does, you can't put down your other things you're already working on. And maybe it robs some of your album songs, who knows. But so I'm trying to compartmentalize an album, an EP for this label, and then this Space Dust EP as well. And it's going well, actually. Somehow it's actually going well.
Yeah, it seems like it's going well. I like all the songs. Like, I guess I want to ask too, like, you know, I think you do social media really well. Mm. Like, I see you on social media, you're checking in a lot, you're very authentic, you're putting up good music. Like, I know that that's like a whole job in itself.
Yeah.
And at least with this 80-day thing, you're kind of just documenting what you're doing. So yeah. Kind of, it's like, hey, like we could just document this opposed to having to create something to post. You're already doing that.
A kind of a funny thing about that is when I first started that, I think I had a little bit of a dream that was going to be my post every day. But part of me was like, oh, great. Then I have my post every day. All I'm going to do is day 47. Here's what I'm doing. But those posts don't do very well. So those have become an extra post for me to where I'm making it only for my story.
Is it that there's too much, like that the algorithm is like,
the algorithm just doesn't really like it. You know, I've even noticed like bigger artists like Barclay Crenshaw and stuff. He doesn't do that on his
Reels
on his posts, Reels or anything, you know, because the algorithm just doesn't like it as much.
It's weird. Something might have changed too. Like a while ago when I was, you know, really getting into the social media game, it was like, you know, post almost like the more you post, the better. Like there was a certain limit, right? But now I think it's about the quality a little. Like I think they changed the algorithm a bit. Yeah. Something.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. It seemed like they were wanting you to just constantly, even twice a day, sometimes as long, you know. But I think now I've noticed if I take a break a little bit here and there, it's better.
Yeah.
It needs to breathe a little bit. And maybe it has to do with your following too. If you have a voracious following that's just like Subtronics can probably just post 3 times a day and it'll just be gobbled up.
Yeah, it's good either way. Yeah, you know? Yeah. That's true. Yeah, I mean, one of the questions was kind of like about do you ever just feel like, oh, I just don't want to do the social media thing and just make music?
Yeah.
Like all the time. Yeah, it's like, most people.
Yeah. I have to be honest. If I didn't have to do it, I wouldn't, you know, I would only do music. I would be a hermit up in the mountains by an ocean and just create music and release it, to be 100% honest. I do enjoy I have a film minor and I've always wanted to make films. So the thing is to really do what I want to do, it would take so much time and so much effort and I'm a one man show, you know, like I'm doing everything that I don't have the time to get into it at that point, but I do have some fun with some concepts here and there, but
yeah,
hopefully someday I have a little bit of a team where I can I can launch into some of these ideas I have, you know, and go a little, have a little bit more fun with it. But
yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. You get a little bit more help. You know, one thing I also wanted to ask you was about how, you know, you were talking about getting releases on labels and how that's important. You know, you've released on a lot of really cool labels, SoundCloud collectives. I mean, just to name a few, Bass Rush, The Dub Rebellion, Headbang Society, Low Freak Records, Spicy Boy. I mean, these are like the guys in the game. And I'm curious kind of like how that stuff comes to be. Do you mainly focus on the music and then someone reaches out to you, or do you actively go seek and try to kind of sell to these places?
Yeah, it's probably a little of both, but a little bit more reaching out, you know, and just sending them a new tune. It's like, if I have a tune that I think is going to be good for Spicy Boys, and I've gotten to know some of those guys through playing shows, now I have a little bit of a camaraderie and friendship, you know, and I'll be like, hey, Miso, check this track out. I think it'd be good for your Spicy Boys label. It just seems to fit, you know, so I'll reach out and send something like that.
Like kind of raising your hand, like, hey, I got something, if yeah. It makes sense. Yeah, I feel like I always ask this question because I think people who are up and coming, it's valuable to them. But the more I ask it, the more I get the same answer, which is, you know, there's a little bit of that camaraderie that goes a long way. Maybe you play a show and you meet someone and then you're like, oh, this guy's cool. And then you just have that connection that it's yeah. like person to person. Those are the connections that go so far.
Yeah, for sure. You know? I think it comes through your passion of what you're making too. You know, like there are only certain people making Spicy Boys type beats, you know? And so you get to know those people, and the people who are really passionate doing it are probably doing it at a high level after a while where it just makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it just, you're going to meet on the road, you're going to meet at a show, and you're probably going to get along because you're both obsessing about the certain sound design and you have shit to talk about. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It just, it's a natural thing. I think that people, you got to get out there. Like,
yeah, you definitely got to get out there.
Meet people in person. That's like the yeah. biggest.
And I'm pretty shy with that too, to be honest. Like I'll be pretty quiet. Most of, like, I've met some people that I couldn't believe I was meeting. Like I met G Jones at one point and I just love him. And of course I just clam up, you know,
just like, hi.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. Yeah. I was just like, hey, you're really cool. Something lame and stupid, but yeah, it is important. And I see people who are great at it, who maybe, you know, are getting a lot further cause they're just really good at socializing.
The social, yeah.
They get it. You know, they get how important it is, how important a meeting like that can be.
Yeah,
for sure.
What do we think of the whole like black and white aesthetic? And the reason I'm asking you this is because, you know, you have an art background and it's just very like mind control-y, like black and white, stark contrast. And it, like, I remember there was this image that's like this black and white illusion that they were like, yeah, if you look at this image for so long, it literally changes your brain. And I'm like, what? But there is something powerful just about that like hypnotic, stark black and white thing. And with the dimensions, it's looking, you know, it's looking along those lines, kind of that G Jonesy. Not to say that you're doing G Jones stuff, but it's just, he's like on that black and white aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah. I love his aesthetic. He's crushing that. This wasn't really influenced by him, even though I really, really love his stuff. It's more what I feel the type of music that I'm kind of, I do a big variety of music. It's probably not smart in having a music career. Cause I'm kind of, you can't say he's old school dubstep or he's deep dub or he's experimental bass music or whatever. I kind of do an amalgamation of a lot of that stuff, but this music specifically was to me, it was black and white. It was like deep dub to me is black and white. I think Truth is doing a good job with Deep Dark and Dangerous. It's black and white. There's something about it that is, it just, you're not dealing with as big of a palette or something. And it's a little bit of a, like how Peekaboo and Skrillex have been branding their new stuff. I think there's something kind of more, what's the word? Impactful, you know. It's just, it's a little bit more graphic, it's a little more stark, it's a little bit more dirty, gritty. And I think there's something about Deep Dub that has that feeling. And so, and then the art style is kind of visionary art style. It's a style
with
that
the eyes,
with the eye and the swirl, you know, there's a lot of artists that are playing into that, and it's psychedelic.
Yeah. Visionary meaning that this is like, yeah, like a different dimension, like you're going into a place, right, traveling through possibly psychedelics or something like
1960s that. 1960s psychedelic, those posters with that swirl, that was the start of it. Psychedelic music. And that's it. I'm doing an extension of that. So to me, it was the best representation of like what I'm bringing you into.
The Butterscotch EP. So yeah, complete difference in art style there. Very colorful, very poppy colors. And I also saw that you sold that as an NFT. Mm-hmm. And that just seems like a cool thing to do. I don't know. Yeah. How did that go for you?
Yeah. So that artist, Pez Banana, amazing. Like, absolutely love his stuff. We were developing this relationship where he created that art. I would art direct and kind of sketch out what I'm wanting, and then he would just flawlessly nail it in his style. Psychedelic, bringing in my character, and at that time more, you know, that music is a little bit more, how would you describe it? You know, it's a little higher energy. It's a little bit more wacky. It's a little bit more, you know.
It's interesting that we're talking about the psychedelic stuff, because it's like you got the black and white mind control, like that kind of era of psychedelics. And then you have full spectrum color psychedelics, which is like, that also goes with it.
Totally. And Dimensions Part 2 mix is going to come out, and that's going to be full spectrum. And I'll, like, as I'm branding it, as I'm, or, you know, releasing that stuff, I'm going to be taking people on that journey, and why this is like full color technicolor spectrum. And, but yeah, I don't know if it's smart that I go back and forth like that or not. It's just, to me, like each album has a specific kind of feeling and theme, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if I worry too much about it being like a smart play or not. Like, kind of depends on what you're trying to just get out of the whole career, I guess. I don't know.
It's like, I guess from just talking to manager types and other people in the business, they're going to tell you, find the song that blew up for you and just pretty much use that. Make more of that. Use those sounds, use those structures, use those, the feeling of that. And that's how you become recognizable as an artist. Like, think about the Beastie Boys. They have one kind of thing that they did. I mean, they did kind of branch out and do some instrumental kind of, you know, stuff, but it's mainly one thing that they got really good at. And it is kind of the smartest way to make it. It's the way to do it. I'm not doing that. Like, I'm doing a big variety of music, and I just feel like it's more authentic. Like, I want to be making the kind of music I want to make.
Yeah.
If I'm in it and my heart is in it, then you can trust that I'm behind it, you know, and I think it comes through. I think a listener, I think most listeners go and look at who the artist is when they like a song, and they kind of determine what they feel about that person. You know, they check them out. And I also don't really feel like I could make music that was homogenized into one thing. And like, it's just not me.
Yeah. So that's the thing. I feel like the people who are just like obsessed with one specific thing, they can go far with that, right? Because they keep making that and they make different iterations. I could also see you pigeonholing yourself doing that. But I feel like you have to create kind of based on your style. Like, if you like a lot of different styles, because it's just something that I hear from people that they'll say kind of like, yeah, I should really like maybe just focus on like one thing I do really well, be easier to brand, whatever. Yeah. But at the same time, if it doesn't feel like you, it's tough. I don't know. I think a good way for people to do it is like make a body of work that is, this is me, I don't even know what I'm talking about, but this is just what I see. Like, make a body of work, make an album in a style that you really like, and then like just the next one make something different or something. I don't know. That's just like, doing. Yeah.
That's what I would do. But if you look throughout the history of music, Pink Floyd, each of those covers are pretty different. You know, Pink Floyd, The Wall has a whole theme to it. Dark Side of the Moon has a whole theme to it. It goes, and I think as a listener, you enjoy those different journeys. So why not explore those things, you know? And I think it just depends on the type of artist and what you're doing and how that makes sense to you. Some artists might not need much art. Bob Dylan doesn't need a whole lot of art. His face on the cover is enough. You know, it just really depends on the actual music and the art and the artist. And I feel like I have really worried at times, like, oh shit, I'm going into this whole black and white thing. Like, how is it going to be perceived? But I'm like, you know what? It resonates with me and I feel like it's interesting and I feel like it's a fun world and I'm bringing people somewhere new, you know? And if they start to follow me more, who knows what to expect with my next thing. That seems like kind of a fun adventure to me.
How's the balance of production and then the DJing side of things? Like, what's 2024 looking like DJ wise, gigs wise?
So the balance, I think it's more production this year. I have been doing quite a few shows, this past Dimensions tour, but that's going to slow down a little bit here. I don't have a whole lot of festival bookings. I would like more. There's going to be some that I'm really stoked about. I think I'm going to get a rhythm in the studio a little bit more. It's probably going to be about like 80% in the studio. And cause it's hard too. When you go down the road, it breaks your flow. You know, you got to get back into it. It takes you 3 or 4 days or something to get back in that flow. So I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Doing the production and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's another thing. The thing that I think about with this podcast, if anything, it can highlight the similarities between artists to kind of give you like a mental map. And that's something people say a lot too, is that, you know, it kind of messes with my flow. I got, it takes me days to kind of like get out of tour DJ mode.
Yeah. It's a different mode, but it's funny. And this is maybe something that a lot of people are saying too, but the DJ mode is, what's the word? Insightful for the writing mode. You're in the dark if you're just writing constantly for months at a time. You need to get out and see what's working and also see what's working in the big world of things, not only your music, you know, and find out what's going on, because you get kind of out of touch with that a little bit. Things change, you know. But I think you need the kind of balance of it.
Yeah. What were you saying?
Well, when I come home from a string of shows, I got all these ideas.
Oh. So, but it takes like a buffer time to kind of like get them out. Right. Maybe. Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I feel like, just from my experience of DJing too, like you kind of like learn structure too, in a way. Like you play songs because you're trying to figure out how to blend them into each other. And then it starts making you think about, how do I structure this song? Like songs that I like to, you know, so it's like
work better live.
Yeah. It can kind of give you that perspective also. Yeah.
Or I need a better opener. I need a better opener that kind of gives this whole theme
work on, like an opener. Cinematic opener or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like hook people in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. Or I need a few more bangers, or I need, you know, some more remixes. I notice my remixes are going really well.
That's actually another thing I wanted to ask you about. You know, you got a lot of tracks. I haven't seen a lot of collabs, and I'm curious how you feel about collaborating with people.
I love it. Yeah. I wish I could do it more. It's honestly, I would like to more. I just haven't had the chance. Yeah, it's and they take a long time to get done too. Like I have one with Super Future that we're pretty much done with, but I think we've sat on it for 3 years.
Wow.
But it takes like the coordination of like, hey, I'm ready to, let's just finalize it and go through, you know. So it's those kind of things. And then just somebody hit me up, ask me, you know, like I'm down. I'm way down. Sometimes I ask people and they're like, yeah, I'm down. And then it never happens. And then months later, they're like, oh, you should have just hit me back or whatever. And it's like, I don't want to bug the person. You know, I'm pretty like, I don't know.
You're kind of like par of the course. You're like doing your own thing. And if someone was like, yeah, let's do it. Like, you'd be like, oh, okay, cool. We can go this direction too. But
totally.
But otherwise you're kind of like doing your thing.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like when you text somebody too, it's kind of a, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but I just don't like to overdo it, you know?
Yeah. It could feel kind of like, let's do this because it'll be beneficial for both of us or something.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I just want it to like, be authentic. I want it to be a natural progression. Like, hey, we like each other's music. Let's work on something. We have a cool idea. Let's do it. You know?
You know, I also saw in this EDM identity thing that you were talking about doing a Star Monster show inspired by Midnight Gospel and Adventure Time, which are kind of similar.
Yeah.
I haven't finished Midnight Gospel, but I remember like, it's a dope show, and then they canceled it or something, or they like stopped production on it, but I feel like people love it.
Yeah, it's legendary in my opinion. Like, I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's like a little darker than Adventure Time.
It's trippier, yeah. It's more adult.
Yeah.
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 But yeah, those, I love those so much. Yeah, we have 15 minutes done of the cartoon.
Really?
Yeah. I think I'm going to need to GoFundMe though to like get the rest of it done, because it's expensive doing cartooning and I've run out of money for it. But it's cool. It's called the Star Monster Show right now. That's the initial name for it. And it's a little star monster. He lives on a mirror galaxy to ours, on an Earth that's a mirror to ours. And then this evil lord comes down. All of the star monsters on their planet, the result of any action is always good. So no matter what they do, it's always good. They're always making music and everything is fun and wonderful. This evil lord hates that, and he comes down and they all scatter and there's this kind of war. But Star Monster gets, my Star Monster, Jethro, gets sucked through this black hole, winds up on our Earth, and then starts getting into all this trouble. He has this this policeman, Sergeant Pepperoni, hates him, and he's always trying. So there's all these characters, and it's just this kind of ridiculous, you know, situation where he's eating a cop car and all this crazy stuff happens.
Wow. So tell me, because it's like, you got like, I know Major Lazer, they did the show, the Major Lazer show, and that was actually cool, and it had like a lot of really cool music on it. And I'm kind of curious what like the lofty aspirations are for this show. Like,
yeah, I mean, I'm super lofty on it. I wanted to have original music in it from myself, and kind of like more like Adventure Time, where it's just like quirky stuff and background stuff. And it's mainly the humor of the show and the theme of the show and the characters that take you through it. But yeah, I'm like, I've got, it's all in the works.
That's a whole world. Yeah.
Whole world. Yeah. I wish I could launch myself completely into it, you know, but the idea is to get the pilot done now, try to get Adult Swim into it and get some backing and really do it.
That would be so cool. I would love to watch that.
I know. I'm so stoked. The characters are so fun. My daughter helped me make a lot of these characters, and
amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Are you working with a specific artist on this?
I was working with one guy who's no longer doing it. So now I need to find another artist and get it completed.
Do you think that, have you thought about how like the interplay between what you're doing with your music and touring, and how that could feed into the show and how they could feed off each other? Like, do the visuals from the show go into the visuals of
I've already been using them for my show.
Oh.
Yeah. We're already showing them back there. So yeah, completely. Like the way Ganja White Knight is doing it, even though that is totally not what I'm going for, the way they're doing it is it works the same way. Like their live show has their Mr. Wobble and
right.
things are happening. And like, why couldn't Star Monster be doing the same thing? And maybe new clips of the show could come out for certain shows in the future.
And is the Mr. Wobble thing, they don't have like videos that are outside of like music videos, right? Or are there like little adventures of Mr.
I think
Wobble?
It's just the music videos for okay. them. Yeah.
And they're great.
They're great. They're
go
amazing.
Check them out. Seriously. Yeah.
Freaking phenomenal.
That's so cool. Was there anything specific that happened that you're like, dude, we got to do this show? Or it's just like, you're just so, I mean, you're so creative, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I think it was just like, I think it just dawned on me. I was like, I want to do a cartoon. Like, I, having gone to art school and being a visual artist, for me, that is like, would be the perfect end for my visual art to have a place to coincide with the music.
Like, yeah, all of the mediums coming together.
A full cartoon show, like a life of little characters.
You ever mess around with D&D?
Oh, a long time ago, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's just like, I have a friend that he got super into D&D and he loves the world building. And I feel like making a show, it's like all about world building.
Totally, I love it. The world of the characters and stuff. Like, I've been telling my daughter this same story, Rabbit of the Sea, since she was like 3 years old. Before she goes to bed, we're on chapter almost 600 now. And it's just this ongoing story about this rabbit and these other creatures that live under the ocean. And they just go on adventures.
So, and is this a story you've made?
I make it up every night. She's
you just make
bed.
It up every
and
night.
And I remember where we were on in the last chapter.
Really?
Yeah. I'm like, somehow I just have that like story thing. Like, I can tell stories like right off the cuff.
Whoa. That's so cool.
Dude.
What?
I if there's one thing I'm good at in life, and I don't think I'm good at much, it's that. Like, I can just do that for some reason. Build in like plots, build in things that are going to happen, build in foreshadowing as I'm going.
Dude, you could do like an audio podcast story thing, and however often you want to do it, like every week, maybe you come on the mic and you just start talking, tell the story, and then you could like fill it in with music or something.
Oh my God.
That would be cool.
That would be amazing.
People do podcasts like that where they're like not interviews, you know, they're
telling
their stories.
Wow.
That could be crazy.
That would be really crazy. I wish I was doing that the whole time. Like,
yeah.
With my daughter. Like, yeah. It's been a good journey.
Well, but there is something precious about it being just for you her. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it could be kind of like, you know, you could tell a story on a podcast, record that, and then someone can make something out of it, and then you can help creative direct with it, and then you don't even have to go full sail into it. You could just start kind of, I don't know, this is just my brain firing right now.
That's cool. Yeah, I've never thought about that. Interesting.
That would be interesting.
That'd be very
interesting. I'm into this idea. Yeah. Damn.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. There's some other random transient things I just wanted to kind of bounce off of you. I saw on your, merch page at the bottom, it says freedom, love, base, and then 333. I'm curious what the numbers signify.
Yes, right here, my knuckles got the 333. It's just an angel number.
Number, yeah.
You know, I like a lot of people, I think, whenever I look at my phone or the clock, it's always like 11:11, and 333 is the one it seems to be quite a bit. And I think for me that the number is like, the number three is just the most beautiful number. You've got birth, life, death. You've got the family unit with, you know.
It's the most structurally, strong shape.
Concise.
I mean, I've heard, okay, this is like, I feel like I've brought this up, that like an arch supported is stronger than a triangle. And this is like going back to my days, we had to build like a toothpick bridge.
Okay.
I remember my dad, he's a contractor, and he was like, yeah, we've got to make it like a triangle because it's the strongest geometrical shape. And I was like, interesting. But going back to the three, three points.
Yeah, it's concise. Can't break it down really. Yeah. It's just a beautiful number. I think it's just something that is a reassuring thing when I see it around. You know, it's just kind of like, yep.
There it is. Yeah.
There it is. Yep.
That's interesting. I definitely, the 11:11 thing, I definitely have that one.
Yeah.
Make a wish.
Yeah. I have that a lot.
I still do that.
I have that a lot. Yeah. Dude, oh my God. There was a time of my life where I was, when I was doing live music, I was playing guitar and just kind of speaking in tongues. I had like cultivated this way of creating music where I would turn off my consciousness and just play guitar and let whatever come through me. And I would record it. And then I had a job that was 4 hours away on the weekends, and I would have to drive there, and I would just play all this stuff back and like listen to all this stuff. I began to, within a day or two of this crazy stuff I was singing, run into somebody by this name or something that was a direct tie, not like looking for a far, you know, like, oh, well,
this it's kinda, not just like synchronicity.
Yeah, this
or
is kind of relating, like, no, to the T. And this became an everyday thing for like 6 years. Everyday thing. I was playing guitar for four to six hours and singing this crazy stuff. And I'd always meet somebody by this name or blah, blah, blah. And at this time, I really began to, the clock really started to get crazy for me. It was always 1-1-1. It was always 3-3-3. It was always 1-2-3-4. Like, it almost never anything but that.
Do you ever, like, does that ever worry you either? Or do you feel like you're in good hands?
I feel like I'm in good hands. I mean, the only thing I could figure, because it wasn't telling me anything. It, to me, it was just like, you're on the right path. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're on the right path. This is reassurance.
Yeah.
So 3-3-3 is that for me, going back to those times. It was just something that was a phenomena that was happening on its own. And it's like, I'm not a person, like, I've restored old 1800s houses. Almost all of them are old. I don't really believe in ghosts till I see it. I'm a very hard to, you know, convince person, but this is just something that was just happening all the time. So
That's interesting. Do you consider yourself like a spiritual person?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Somewhat psychic. Like, I think I have some psychic ability from my grandma too. And I don't really know much about it. I just know how it creeps up. I know how it shows itself.
Why do you think from your grandma specifically?
Well, she could read cards. She was always like talking to ghosts and recognizing ghosts and all this sort of stuff. And she was the person in my family that was most like me. She was from France and she just had this quality about her and the way she did things. It's kind of where I got some of who I am, I think. And then I think it was running pretty strong in her.
You got some of those genes. Yeah.
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 Interesting.
The psychic stuff. And I, like I said, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I don't think it really, you have to know. I think it's just part of you, you know?
Yeah.
Also, something you were talking about when you're kind of like speaking in gibberish type of thing.
Tongues, yeah.
People, you know, when people write like a melody or they're trying to figure out lyrics, like that's such a common thing that people do to just get something out there. And I think like a lot of artists recognize that, but other people would be like, what is this guy doing, you know?
Totally.
To me, it doesn't even faze me. I'm just like, yeah, that's what people do to get a melody, get a, you know, just whatever, let it out, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, just for people who might not know, gibberish can help.
Yeah.
Or tongues.
That's how I wrote almost all my songs back in the day. I would just hit record and just let it come out. And even if it was crazy, I would just play it and write out what it sounded like.
Yeah, and then you put in the words later.
Right.
Yeah.
Put in the words. Like, it kind of sounds like I'm saying the seagulls fly down and grab a cherry.
Yeah. And that's metaphorical. You know, talking about guitars, too, this was something, you know, I should have mentioned when we were going over the Dirt Bros, but a collection of 300 guitars at one point. What was going on there? That's a lot of guitars.
Yeah, dude. It was probably, you know, I didn't have them all at once. Mm-hmm. Is this over the course of that time? That's how many I went through. But I was just obsessed. I was really obsessed at finding the sound that I wanted. And this feeling when I play on stage, your guitar is also like part of your entity, you know? So it was just really important for me to find the right one. And I just kept trying them out and going through them and wound up with three that I really fell in love with and played most of my shows with. One had belonged to Howlin' Wolf. I'm convinced.
Whoa.
I'm convinced. Super old, weird Supro that was a one-off. It wasn't in production because I owned probably most of the guitars I owned were National, Supro, Airline, which are all the same. And I probably had like 200 and some of those, and I knew every model, I knew every freaking year, you know, and this one was never in production. I saw a video of Howlin' Wolf playing the same one. It plugged in the wrong place. It plugged in up here.
Oh.
This pick guard that they had for it. Anyways, that was stolen from me. Yeah, about 5 years ago.
Oh my God. This is like people I want to fight for you.
Thank you, dude. Yeah. I'll call you up.
Yeah, hit me up. Yeah. Yo, I got it. I'm your hitman. So do you still have like a guitar at least that's like your go-to?
Yeah, you know, the weird thing is, to be totally honest, I've sold all the really nice ones. I have my one main one that I've used for almost everything. The Howlin' Wolf one is stolen. And I'm using this kind of junky cheap one I got long ago.
Gets the job done.
It's weird, like my mental state is that I put so much into guitar music for so long, I don't want to care now. I want to just use something that I don't care about.
And do you still use the guitar to write music?
Yeah. I'm in the process of writing all this like new lyric singing stuff.
Mm.
With guitar, it's going to be a different project.
Mm. Can we talk about it? Or
yeah, if you want to.
Yeah, I'm just curious. We could just maybe go into it just for a sec.
Yeah, so I was doing the guitar thing with the Dirt Bros and stuff for a hell of a long time. Lot of touring, a lot of shows. Like I said, we never cared about promoting ourselves one bit. It was like we were making woodcut posters for our posters each show. And anyways, that ran its course. I got into what I'm doing now and I love that. But I miss singing and playing guitar. I haven't picked up my guitar in 6 years. So finally, like 6 months ago, I was ready. I was like, okay, now I'm moving into a new project. I'm still going to be doing Star Monster, but I want a new project where these ideas I have, I can do. And so I've been writing, I think I have about 6 songs now where guitar and singing are happening. And it's just very straightforward, like pop kind of music, but.
Is it electric guitar or acoustic or?
A little of both.
A little of both. Nice. Wow. And is this, I don't know. I'm trying to think like, I don't know. I mean, there's just so much like music coming out of you. It seems hard to compartmentalize.
Yeah. It is. I have a vision for how I want it to flow here over the next years.
Yeah.
And, I think it's going to happen like that.
Nice, man. Well, I'm rooting for you, man. Send me music. I would love to hear it.
Hell yeah, dude.
Yeah.
I will for sure.
Let's wrap this baby up. I got two questions. People are going to be like, why didn't you ask this earlier? But my, normally I start the podcast with a fun question, which is just, what was your first concert that you attended?
Mm-hmm. Elton John.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no wrong answers here. Elton but that John. Does seem like a good one.
It was Elton John and then Steve Miller Band.
Nice.
Back in the day.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where was the Elton John?
Cleveland, Ohio. It was at this place called the Coliseum. I think I was like 5 years old and I smelled my first pot smoke ever.
Yeah, it was wafting in the crowd.
It was wafting, and I was like, what is that smell? What the hell is that?
A little contact high, maybe, because, you know, you're young, so maybe the particles affected you
probably
slightly more because you're sensitive? I don't know.
I was excited, dude. I couldn't believe I was at a concert with all these people, and we were in the back nosebleeds, like, way up high, you know, but I was so excited by it.
That's cool. Okay, so the second question, which is normally the wrap-up question, is what was the most impactful concert that you've been to? Like something where you went to and you were like, damn, I need to change my game.
The R.L. Burnside.
I like how you just had concert. One.
Yeah. The first time I saw R.L. Burnside is when I really started creating that whole Dirt Bros style, the whole blues style I was doing. I had loved him for a long time, but then seeing him live, it was just like, it felt like, you know, those biplanes, those old like two layer planes from felt like one of those, like for the first time lifting off the ground, like every song felt like the intro would kind of start. And then this like old, like plane could like lift off the ground. And it was just incredible. Like the buoyancy of that beat and that music was just like, got me.
It's an interesting way to describe it because it's so specific. It's not just like the first flight. It's like that type of plane specifically, yeah, where it's like the odds are against it almost.
Right.
It's like, is this thing even meant to fly?
You know, when you see them fly and you're kind of like, oh, that's weird. And some might have three wings. But like those first ones, you're just kind of like, man, that just doesn't seem like it's going to fly. And then it does. And you have this feeling of like, oh, it's really light and made out of balsa wood. Or, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird feeling.
Weirdly, that, now that I'm thinking about it, seems like it would fly. But when I look at like a jet, I'm like, that doesn't make sense either.
Right.
It does make sense. But how it's so it heavy. Yeah. It's just so much propulsion that it's like, yeah.
Every time I fly, I'm amazed by it. It's like, who figured this out?
Yeah.
Jesus.
The Wright brothers.
And then it's pretty like smooth.
Yeah. No, it's like, if I think about it too much when I'm on the plane, I'm like, this doesn't seem like it should work.
Totally.
And also we're going down.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's the most bizarre. I flew this few days ago and again, I was thinking, I was like, okay, is it because of how big it is that it can be so smooth? Like we're going 700 miles an hour. Choppy air. How is this freaking thing so smooth?
They figured it out, man. It's wild.
What the fuck was it?
I don't know, man.
The first experiment, like, okay, let's try it.
Guy's like, oh shit, here we go.
Strap him in.
Yeah, dude. Well, we've gone over so much stuff. I'm like, no, I feel like I'm like jumping all over the place, and I'm sorry, guys, but there's just been so many interesting stories that you have, and I'm really thankful that you were able to just talk about some of those.
We're going to Burning Man,
bro. Love to go to Burning Man.
We got more.
I like need to go. Me and my girlfriend were just like,
you would be a blast to go with.
Love to go.
I got you.
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that because like I want to make that happen. I want to go one time in my life, you know.
Yeah,
because it's that festival.
You have to. Everybody has to.
Okay. I'm not like the best outdoorsy person, but it's like this just seems different.
Yeah, I just got to spend the money on the RV with the AC.
Okay.
And then it's easier.
My girlfriend's from Michigan, so she like...
She might be able to handle it.
She knows better. Yeah, she's better than me. I'm like a city boy at this point. But let's run it, man.
Let's do it.
So before we go, I always like to ask, are there any shout outs to anyone who's just... Anyone you want to shout out? People that have been helpful in your career?
Yeah, man. Shout out Steven Click. My agent, he set this up.
Shout out.
Shout out Ethan, my other agent. He's wonderful. Shout out my daughter, Elva.
Shout out.
Love of my life.
Dude, I want to hear some of these stories. I'm like jealous that she just gets to hear them. Like, I want some.
Yeah. They're a good thing to fall asleep to for sure.
Yeah. Dude, you could do like lullaby music.
Ooh. Down.
We got to workshop this podcast idea.
Let's go.
I'm in podcast brain. Okay. And where can people find you? On the internet, that is.
Starmonster.org is the website. Star Monster's on pretty much everything, Instagram and TikTok and Spotify, SoundCloud, iTunes, Bandcamp, you know, all the places.
The works. Yeah. Cool, man. Well, dude, thank you again for coming through.
Thank you so much.
I know you had some traffic, but I think
it's all good.
I'm like stressed about someone else's traffic. I'm like,
we're gonna go get some dank food now.
Thank you for listening. If you've made it this far, we appreciate you, and we'll catch you next time.
Love you, Starfleet.
Peace.